Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Kimberly Stringer is a 28-year-old woman from Bucks County who has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. WITF's Transforming Health reporter Brett Shoulders documented Kim's struggles after she refused to take her medications and see a therapist while she was living in a shed, drank water from streams and ponds, and collected refuse from garbage containers, all while she had an apartment and access to drinking water and food. Brett also described the efforts of Kim's parents, who tried to have her committed to a hospital for treatment involuntarily. Last week, Brett started getting collect calls from inmates at the Bucks County Jail about Kim Stringer. He's here today to describe what happened and tell more about Kim's story. Brett Shoulders, welcome to the program.
Hey there, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment you'd like to weigh in on this story, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Brett, starting off, I have to say this is one of the most heartbreaking stories I think I have ever heard. I have to say that it's one of those stories that when you hear it, it almost brings tears to your eyes. But let's go back. Let's go back to last year when you profiled Kim Stringer and you were contacted by her mother. Tell us about Kim and what she was going through last year.
Yeah, Scott. Last year, we were in the midst of a mental health series that we called Through the Cracks that was about targeting problem areas in mental health services in Pennsylvania. And Martha Stringer reached out to me from Bucks County because she was very concerned about her daughter, who has been diagnosed at various points with both bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder. And there's a term, not to get too far into medical terminology, there's a term called anosognosia, which means lack of insight, and a significant percentage of people who have borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder, or schizophrenia can also have anosognosia, which means they don't have insight into their problems or their conditions. And Kim very much exemplifies that circumstance. So I went out to talk with the Stringers, and just spending one day with them and meeting Kim, I walked away thinking that, you know, Kim is someone she's very sensitive to her surroundings. She's very artistic and thoughtful, but she's also just clearly has a mood disorder and disordered thinking and is preoccupied with a couple obsessions that are not grounded in reality. And so to me, I was shocked and appalled to hear that she was in county jail, because I know, having met her, that not only does she not belong there, but that it was going to be horrible for her.
Now, just to backtrack, before we get to the phone calls from the Bucks County Jail, basically what you're saying is that Kim wouldn't admit or didn't recognize that she had a mental illness or several mental illnesses, correct?
Yeah, so exactly. That's part of her disorder, is she kind of has a somewhat elaborate rationalization that the mental health system is flawed and so on and so forth. But this is all pretty commonplace if you talk to psychiatrists and experts on this. And so she, after that story last summer, she did end up having an acute incident, getting involuntarily committed, on a 5-week stay, and then she was put on a 90-day outpatient commitment, where she was free to, you know, live in her apartment and live her life, but she also was getting a monthly injection of a serious of an antipsychotic medication, and she was getting regular therapy, and she got better. She got really a lot better. She was able to do things like go to the grocery store, which would have been unheard of. She was able to apply for food stamps. She was eating better on her own, and to hear her mom tell it, she was able to be social and interact with people and laugh and smile again and just be more, just seem, you know, happier. And while she was far from over her illness, she was making progress.
One of the reasons, and I want to point this out, that you did this story on Kim to begin with, and now the follow-up, before we do get into the events of the last week, is that it points out some of the difficulties of getting treatment for those who are living with a mental illness. And another issue is that there are too many people who are incarcerated who are suffering from mental illness and probably should be in a hospital or getting treatment rather than being in jail. So that's the big picture issue, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, first of all, it is tough. And when it comes to someone with a mental illness, because we value our freedom and our civil rights, and it's a slippery slope if a person commits someone else. And that's why we safeguard those rights so much, you know, here in the U.S. But as a sort of a side effect of that, it can also be very difficult to mandate or require treatment for somebody if they don't want it. And I would actually argue that, you know, the idea of that a person doesn't want it it starts to become hard to even say what will or agency a person has whenever they're in that kind of condition. But anyway, yeah, so that's really part of the challenge. And then, as you noted, because of the lack of ability to get people treatment in our system, what sweeps them up instead is the legal system, because inevitably a person, their behavior is erratic and unacceptable. They're doing things like making terroristic threats or telling someone you're going to kill them, basically, which is what Kim did to her neighbor, or simple assault. And these behaviors are not the result of malice in the way that most people would define that. It's the result of disordered thinking, and it's the result of a mental illness.
Hmm. All right, so let's talk about the events of the last week. What happened? You started getting messages or collect phone calls from inmates at the Bucks County Prison?
Yeah, Friday late afternoon, I was winding down my work week, and I got an email from the parent of an inmate. And apparently it had taken the inmates a while to figure out Kim's last name. And once they figured it out, the inmate's mom Google searched her name, found the story we did last summer, and she contacted me. And then I gave her my number, and inmates started calling me collect to report what they said was going on, and the reports were pretty shocking, and shocking enough that we decided we just needed to push through and produce a story pretty quickly to let people know what was going on there.
Well, here's one of them. Karen Wood was one of the inmates at the Bucks County Jail who contacted you, and we have a sound clip here of that phone call that Karen had with you. Let's listen to it now.
Well, she's been completely naked. They don't get her clothes on. She sits in her own feces for a long period of time. She touches on herself. And when she hits her head, they go in there and mate her because they're trying to put the mates through the door, and they'll just, like, mate her. It's like mental health. She's not in the right mindset.
So that obviously wasn't the best quality. I assume she's calling from a payphone at the county jail. But what she was saying there is that Kim was, you know, she was soiling herself, you know, had urinated on herself, was completely naked in the cold cell, and that all she had, you know, that she was being maced by some of the jail guards, too. So that was just one, but you received several other calls, and from what I understand, Brett, they were very similar in what they described, correct?
Yes. I was cautious about using the inmates' accounts, and my editors and I decided only to use parts that all three had agreed upon. So several of the key facts that were there. And the other thing we looked into was if the fact was corroborated by County Commissioner Diane Ellis-Marseglia whenever she spoke to Martha. So we were cautious about that. The only caveat I'll give is that two of the three inmates described the incidents where Kim had been pepper sprayed. And Marseglia says that she's looking into whether or not that happened. So she acknowledged that it's something that could have happened, but she isn't saying whether or not it has. And I'm determined to find out what happened on that front as well.
Marseglia is the Bucks County Commissioner that Martha Stringer contacted, correct?
Right. So Martha was... Let me just walk back and note that Martha had no idea that any of this was going on. You know, her and her husband had just been told that their daughter was safe and that they couldn't provide any more information because it would break, like, HIPAA or because their daughter hadn't signed off on a waiver. Again, this notion that a person needs to show their own will or agency really breaks down when a person is virtually catatonic in their cell. So that was the excuse that county officials gave. But, you know, sure enough, as soon as Martha confronted them with the testimony of the inmates, those same county officials, or at least one of them, did start to, in fact, provide details.
It just, and to point out that Martha, Kim's mother, as you said, she was told that her daughter was safe, but COVID-19, the pandemic, entered into this as well, so that Martha, the parents, couldn't visit Kim in jail, and they really didn't have any contact with her for a while, right?
Yeah, it's hard to say just how much of a role COVID-19 played, but one thing is for sure, people were barred from going to the prison to do, or the jail to do, in-person visits as a result of the virus, and so they weren't able to visit her. Now, it's always possible that they could have showed up and been turned away if Kim had been on suicide watch. So we can't blame COVID-19 too much here. It did complicate things, but a lot of these factors that were in play are things that have nothing to do with the coronavirus. It has to do with existing policies and rules that make it really hard for concerned family members and friends and advocates to check in on people with a mental illness in jail, and that also make it really hard for people with mental illness to have any allies or advocates when they're in that situation. I mean, the advocates, the only people who spoke up were the inmates.
We'll talk more about this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For more information on mental illness, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. WITF's Transforming Health reporter Brett Schultes is our guest on this portion of today's program, describing a story that he just produced on Kimberly Stringer, a woman who is living with a mental illness. She was jailed in Bucks County under horrendous conditions, and we will get to what transpired this week as a result of several inmates reaching out to Brett and the follow-up on that. If you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Brett, there may be people who are just tuning in right now, and maybe they didn't quite understand Karen Wood's description. So if you would, describe the conditions in which Kim Stringer was living. I hate to even use the word living, but that she was enduring in the Bucks County Jail, according to these inmates who contacted you.
Yes, according to the three inmates and confirmed by the county commissioner, Kim did not have clothes. She was on suicide watch, and it's unclear how long she had been. They'd taken her clothes away. She had a blanket that was soiled. She had a anti-suicide smock, which is a garment given to people who are on suicide watch, but she wasn't wearing it. She was in her own excrement and waste, and she was hurting herself at times. And she had also allegedly been pepper sprayed or maced, as the inmates say, and had been alleged mistreatment had happened to her as well. So the conditions were pretty horrific.
The three inmates who contacted you, one of the reasons that it took so long was, as you mentioned, they didn't know her name. How could they not know her name? And did they ask? Could Kim volunteer this information? There was some time lapse there because they couldn't identify who Kim was.
Yeah, a lot of what didn't make it into my story was how kind these inmates were to her and how they went above and beyond to sort of try to take care of her. The inmates would be given the role of an inmate observer when someone was on suicide watch to make sure to kind of keep an eye on her. And I think it was under those circumstances that they really got to care about her and know who she was. Now, Kim was not really speaking very much so it was hard to get her last name. And I think she had given them a name earlier that they misheard or something, so they thought her name was something other than what it actually was. And but, you know, hearing the women's accounts, you know, 59-year-old Linda Ennis, you know, she was on work release for a DUI whenever COVID-19 hit, and so she was moved into that facility. So there she was, not even, you know, used to be incarcerated. Again, she was on work release. She ends up there and then has this encounter with this, you know, a much younger woman who's in obviously really terrible shape. And Linda told me that she would just try to get her to, you know, to find any positivity in the day. You know, if it was raining out, she'd point to that. If it was sunny out, she'd point to that little bit of sunlight in through the jail window. And occasionally she could get Kim to talk to her a little bit. But, those three inmates were really her, and I'm sure there may have been guards who were kind to her as well. I know they gave some accounts of that, but it's just hard to say because it's difficult to get information about what goes on in a jail.
You know, you talked about, you say it's hard to get information what happened in a jail. I mean, were the people in the jail, the guards, other people in the jail, are they aware? I mean, they obviously knew that there was some mental illness involved. Were any efforts made to try to get Kim treatment rather than just staying in a jail cell?
I don't know, Scott. I've reached out to the county correctional facility multiple times and have gotten no response. In any form, no email, no callback, nothing. Whatever went on there, it didn't help her. And she was in really bad condition. So I don't know whether anyone else made efforts in there to help her. I will say, you know, correctional officers have a certain training, background, and skill set like anyone. And, you know, in my conversation with the district attorney afterwards, you know, he points that out, that, you know, a lot of, whether it's police officers or corrections officers, they're not necessarily trained to look at someone through that lens of psychosis or behavioral disorder or medical disorder. One of the most frustrating things for me was seeing even the county mental health person who was working as a liaison with the courts kept using language that was in emails about Kim that was, you know, legal in nature or criminal in nature. Like, for example, saying that how long it would take for her to get out of jail depended on, quote, her willingness to participate. Well, she has no will. She has no agency. She is catatonic. So they're just beating this ridiculous and impossible goal of getting a person to comply when that person is never going to comply, and they made her so much worse as a result of that. And as Kim's mom put it, you know, she went in unwell, and now that she's out, she's worse. They left her in worse conditions than they brought her in.
Let's take a phone call from James in Lebanon. James, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes. Go ahead.
Last year, the Lebanon City Police abused me, injured me, and robbed me when I was having a nervous breakdown. I called the suicide prevention line, and they did not tell the police the truth. When I proceeded, go ahead.
No, I didn't say anything.
I heard something. I proceeded to go to the hospital, and the police had already been called to me and told, and they were told I was going to wreck my car in the park I was in, and I never said any such thing. They stopped me. I couldn't hear them, anything that they said. And the next thing I knew, I was yanked out of my car by my left arm and thrown headfirst on the asphalt.
Hey, James, before you go any further, I hate to interrupt. That sounds like a horrible experience that you've gone through. But I have to ask what it has to do with, I understand that the phone call has been dropped by accident, but I think the point that James was trying to make is that he also suffers from a mental illness and was dealing with some of the same things that that Kim was. We cannot verify those things live on the air. I will point that out right now. So I just want to point that out, that was just James telling the story, and we cannot verify that live on the air as we speak. So getting back to the Kim's story here, Brett. Where am I here? Okay. Mm-hmm. Getting back to Kim's story. What was she put in jail for in the first place?
Yeah. And Scott, I do want to say to the caller's point, you know, I've gotten a lot of emails from people who want to share their story, and you're absolutely right to say, you know, these stories, I haven't really looked into them, but it seems there is a lot of frustration. And just as an aside, you know, the story in no way mentioned the context of what's going on in this country right now with looking at policing and looking at the way that we were, you know, the way that our police system is set up and our criminal justice system. The story made no mention of that, but it seems that a lot of people, when they were sharing it, were making comments about it that were looking at it through that lens. And so I do think it's worth noting that, you know, as we visit how police do their job and what their role is in society, I think this is probably one of the areas that almost everybody can agree on, that for people like Kim, there has to be a better response than to criminalize that mental illness. But anyway, on that note, I guess it is a transition into a neighbor had called complaining that Kim had punched her and that she had made terroristic threats. Now, I did get to read the probable cause report. Falls Township Police would not release the criminal complaint for the police reports. They say that they don't have to, and I'm working to get that. But the officer showed up, and he could have taken her to the hospital. He could have had her involuntarily committed. Falls Township Police claimed that they spoke with Kimberly's parents and that they wanted her to be jailed. That is not true. That officer, for whatever reason, decided to press charges, and so Kim ended up in jail instead of in the hospital.
And as you said, her mother did not know what was going on. And just for some background purposes, you had touched on this a little bit earlier, that one of the reasons that Kim's mother had contacted you in the first place in writing about this is that her mother and father were unsuccessfully trying to get her committed to a hospital for treatment involuntarily, and because she didn't want to, it was very, very difficult.
Right.
And then to just fill in the blanks here in this story is that the parents did not know what was going on in the jail. They were just told that Kim was safe. All right, so how did Kim's mother find out about what was going on in the jail, and what was her response?
The inmates contacted me. I called Kim's mom, Martha, and Martha was horrified to learn it. She said she actually fell down on her knees after hearing some of the details, and her husband were shocked and furious, and she sent that email to the county commissioner who had been telling her everything's safe, someone who, by the way, never has met Kim. And then at that point, she started getting some details about what was really going on. So it was only after the inmates contacted me that Martha and Paul were able to learn what was happening with their daughter.
So this week there was some movement, and Kim was taken out of the jail and moved. What happened?
Yeah, so I talked to District Attorney Matt Weintraub at Bucks County, and his account is that he became familiar with the story. He read the story, and he and the public defender assigned to Kim formulated a plan to get her promptly moved to Norristown State Hospital. Weintraub notes that there are often a backlog of beds or available spots at the psychiatric facilities. This is something we've reported on. It's been widely reported on, and it's not unique to Pennsylvania. We don't invest money in mental health resources. He said it would have been had there been dedicated spots for someone like Kim, it would have been a lot easier for this to have never happened. But the bottom line is, once they were sort of properly, this problem was identified, and there was a lot of public outcry and an email, a petition to get Kim out of jail on change.org and so forth. And once all that sort of public outcry started happening, they were able to make it happen within 2 days and just get her out of that jail.
So your story, if it wasn't for the inmates contacting you, you doing the story, and Kim's parents, she may still be in that jail.
Well, her trial, I guess it would be called, or her appearance before the judge, court appearance it was supposed to be on June 12th, and then as of June 9th, only when Martha reached out to county officials did she learn that it got continued, and so it wasn't going to be till July 22nd. So, barring some other thing that would have happened in the jail, or if her situation would have deteriorated to some worse point, I don't know. But the plan was for her to, be there until July 22nd. So I think it's fair to say that it's at least possible that she could have been there until July 22nd.
So she is getting treatment now. Where?
Norristown State Hospital, which is a state-run psychiatric facility. And I do just want to note, for anyone who has this outstanding question, that her parents could have easily paid bond. But they chose not to do that because they believed that, first of all, you bail her out, and then she just gets into another altercation because she's in an acute, disordered state. And then she ends up just in more trouble with the law. And secondly, they thought that the system was going to work for her so that she would not end up in jail, because it was so manifestly clear that she was someone who was dealing with a serious behavioral disorder. So that's why they didn't just promptly bail her out afterwards. But yes, she's getting treatment now, and hopefully she's able to kind of get back to her baseline and start to improve. Her parents have seen her in good condition at various points throughout the past couple of years, so they know it's been possible. And hopefully her situation improves now that she's out of jail.
To summarize, Brett, and go back to the big picture here, there are a couple issues, and I mentioned this very early on, but now that everyone has heard Kim's story and has heard what she went through, brings up the point of people who are suffering from mental illness in jail instead of getting treatment, and the difficulty in getting someone treated if they don't want to be treated. Is there anything along the lines now that could maybe help those things, change those things?
Well, I want to follow up on this topic with some experts who we can kind of use this as a case study to look at different points where things went wrong. I mean, I know District Attorney Weintraub says if police have crisis intervention training, they'll be more likely to not press charges against somebody who is who has this past and this diagnosis and who's also exhibiting these behaviors. Kim was very well known to the police department and to the neighborhood, and in the past she had not been charged for that reason. Another thing would be more funding and resources for acute inpatient mental health care, and then just policy changes. I think as we have this conversation about the role of law enforcement in our society and the criminal justice system in our society, one good place to start is looking at a mental health system which protects people from involuntary commitment under many circumstances. But the net result of protecting people and guarding their freedoms is that then ultimately we take away their freedoms because those people inevitably commit crimes. And then they end up mentally ill and in the criminal justice system, which is much less kind to them than the a psychiatrist or the mental health system would be to them.
Let me just add something, Brett. I'm not correcting you, but you used the word inevitable. We have heard many times, and you have even reported this, that most people living with a mental illness are not criminals or violent, put it that way.
Listen, Scott, criminal is one of those words that can mean all kinds of things. You know, the women who helped Kim out in prison are all quote-unquote criminals. They're in there for a DUI, drug possession. A lot of these people themselves just have addiction problems. So, yes, you're right to say that the great majority of people with a mental illness do not become a mass shooter or commit a violent act to hurt someone else. So that's absolutely true. But we criminalize their behavior by taking things that they do, like they're, for example, nude in public. They are sitting on a sidewalk somewhere, saying strange things to every passerby. They are panhandling. They are, intoxicated in public. So these sorts of things that are a result of their behavioral disorders, we then criminalize those behaviors and we press charges on them, and then they become criminals.
Brett Shoulders is WITF's Transforming Health reporter, and we have a link to his story. You also can see it on WITF.org and PAPost.org. Brett, great work. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott. Take care.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and just wanted to talk a bit, and we're going to move on to COVID-19 now. Sports and other activities shut down when schools closed last March near the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. But last week, the Wolf administration released guidelines for high school and youth sports, along with other outdoor activities to resume from the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining us on this segment of today's program is Melissa Nash Mertz. She's Associate Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Interscholastic Athletic Association, Jeremy Flores, Director of Athletics for the Chambersburg School District, and Justin Rose, Associate Executive Director of the Carlisle Family YMCA. Welcome to today's program. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. I may be jumping the gun a little bit here, Melissa, by asking this question, but will there be high school sports this fall?
Well, at this point, I would tell you that we are cautiously optimistic. We are optimistic that we will have fall sports. We may have some modifications to certain things. You know, the landscape may look a little different. The good thing is I think that with the help of the National Federation and some other national bodies, we can probably put in place some modifications just in terms of, you know, spectator entrances, spectator seating, the number of spectators, so forth, social distancing with coaching staff and when kids are on the bench, and things that won't dramatically impact the sport itself or the players. I think our one challenge probably at this point is football, and a lot of that is because if you still end up having counties that are in yellow, but maybe even green, you know, yellow is limited to 25 and green is 250, you know, some of our Friday night football crowds, you know, may be impacted by that. But at this point, we are, you know, I use the term cautiously optimistic because our plan is to move forward with fall sports.
When you gave those numbers, and I wanted to point out that in green counties, 250 means everyone. That
right.
means players, coaches, trainers, officials. That doesn't even count spectators. That would, and then that's the green counties. In the yellow counties, it's no more than 25. That means that, I don't see how you could have a football game if you're in a yellow county.
Yeah, and I think our hope is that, as you've seen, you know, several counties have actually just gone green today, is that we're still, well, a little less than, we're 2 months out, really, from an actual contest taking place. You know, football can't start till the very end of August. So our hope is that by then, you know, we're going to be further down the road, and that by then every county will be minimally green, if not out of that, whatever that next phase is, if it's completely open or whatever the governor's office dictates. But you're absolutely right. Right now, that 250 does include staff, you know, police officers, security, ticket takers, sellers, you know, the athletes themselves, trainers. So that would make it a little bit difficult, and it would present a challenge if we still have that come September, late August.
Jeremy Flores, you're the director of athletics for the Chambersburg School District, one of the largest school districts in central Pennsylvania. So what plans, now that the governor's office has provided some guidelines, what is the Chambersburg School District doing with its athletic programs?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Thanks for having me on. So when we got the guidance from the state, we were fortunate that we've been proactive with a lot of other athletic directors in our area throughout the state, and taking that guidance that Melissa had mentioned from the NFHS and other organizations to create some reopening plans, a health and safety return to sports plan. So at Chambersburg, like you said, with our size district, we're able to have what we call the task force of individuals from WellSpan, administration, coaches, our facilities department, that we all came together to finalize our plans based upon the governor's guidance and then other organizations. So we're fortunate that our school board will be approving our plan this coming Tuesday night, the 23rd, and then we're going to start bringing back our teams slowly. So we're going to start with fall sports on Monday, the 29th, and then wait 2 weeks and bring our winter teams back July 13th, and then 2 weeks later with spring for optional off-season workouts. But of course, we've got different levels within that plan of modifications, that what's allowed, what's not allowed, with the number of gathering, people that can gather. We have limits on hydration stations, on how often we need to clean the equipment, limits on what type of screenings do we have to have for athletes and our staff before they even come into our facilities. So it's been a team effort, but we're excited to finally get back on the field and on the court in some form or fashion.
You said that you mentioned screenings for athletes, and I'm assuming other staff as well. Do those screenings include testing for the virus going that far, or just temperature checks, or just what?
Yeah, so it involves a temperature check with an infrared thermometer that our athletic trainers will use. So if anybody has a temperature of 100.4 or more, they will get sent home. And then the rest of the screening is a questionnaire where we ask them, have they experienced a number of symptoms over the last few days or weeks, and have they been in any close contact with anybody who's tested positive? So it doesn't go as far as a full-on test like you might see at the collegiate or the professional level, because I think that's just a matter of resources that, you know, depending on the district, what they can and can't do. So ours doesn't go as far as a full test, but it is a symptom checker and a temperature check.
You know, as Melissa described, part of the guidelines is to maintain social distancing. I don't know. It's hard to picture. Of course, we've never been through anything like this. It's hard to picture, say, a soccer team, for example, sitting on the bench but having to sit, each player sitting 6 feet apart. I mean, am I exaggerating and that's what it would be like? Or what will social distancing look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think it's different for every sport, and it's going to be different for every district and the type of facility they have. And how it can be set up. And so, you know, some sports are going to be a lot easier to socially distance on the bench or, you know, on the field than others. Tennis, for one, is going to be very easily socially distanced. Cross country will be a lot easier to do. And a sport like volleyball will be as well, just because there's less athletes on the court. But you're right, a sport like soccer, football, field hockey, those are going to be a little bit more difficult, but we're fortunate that at Chambersburg, our facilities are fairly large, that we're going to be able to spread athletes out in a safe manner, we think.
Melissa, who is going to be monitoring this? I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. We're leaving it up to every school. And the big reason that we're doing that is because, you know, just as Jeremy alluded to, you take you know, our state, and even take District 3, and you have some parts of District 3 that are quite rural, and the schools are very small. They don't have the numbers maybe that Jeremy might have at Chambersburg, and the number of teams, the number of athletes, the number of students in the school building. So we're leaving that up to each individual school. We feel they know what's best for their community, for their students, based on the size of their school, the number of athletes they have. We feel that's most appropriate, because we didn't want to put a cookie cutter one size fits all, because that half oftentimes doesn't work real well, just because we're so diverse, not only in District 3, but as you move across the whole state, you get up into areas where we have schools that only have 35 kids enrolled in the school, so which is quite different than somebody like, you know, Jeremy, who's got a huge enrollment at Chambersburg.
You know, we talked about those numbers earlier, the 25 in yellow counties and no more than 250 in green counties. Is there the possibility, Melissa, that, say for, well, any sport, that a school that's located in a yellow county would have to play their games, their contest, in a green county to be able to get under those numbers if we continue in this situation?
Yeah, it's possible. And, you know, the two things that, again, we're trying not to jump too far ahead, just because we feel we have some time yet. And as you've seen, things can change within days. Things can change within hours sometimes. So we're trying not to get too far ahead. But I will tell you that, you know, we've said to schools, we're so excited that we've been able to allow schools to open up their facilities and get kids back into doing some summer workouts and playing athletics and being kids. But at the same time, you know, we offer caution. Please walk before you run. The last thing that we need at this point is a setback and for all of us to get back to a red phase or something of that nature. With that being said, we're also going to reiterate to our schools, we're probably going to have to be flexible and creative in the fall. You might have that scenario that you just named. You might have a scenario where schools were contracted to play each other, but one school knows the other school is in a county that had, you know, a higher rate of incidences of COVID. So, yeah, those are things that we're certainly going to be tackling over the next month or so. We have another board meeting in July where we'll probably have a lot of those. Hopefully by then we'll have more information and know better what the landscape looks like for fall. So I would tell our schools to stay tuned for that.
Justin Rose is the associate executive director of the Carlisle Family YMCA. Justin, the governor's guidelines not just were directed at sports, but we're also talking about other outdoor and indoor activities involving kids. Summer camps, for example. But tell me how the Carlisle Family YMCA is being impacted by COVID-19, and what do these guidelines do? What do they allow you to do?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on. And I would say we've been kind of fortunate, I'd say an advantage to kind of some of the new guidelines, as in we've been running emergency child care since May 4th, so we had a chance to get our toes wet there and see how this was going to play out prior to us opening our day camps. So at the moment, we are just running day camps, which is essentially, you know, a day-long program for youth in our area, specifically our geographical area. And that guidelines are basically based off the CDC guidelines, which are pretty, I would say, well thought out and are doable for us at this point. As we move forward into the summer, I'm sure as many of your other guests can imagine, we hear from a lot of parents that need more care or need longer care. And with some of the stipulations that are put on this for running these camps, we do have to limit our numbers as well as, you know, the hours operation and just what we can manage at this point.
Yeah, just to point out that you're providing child care for many families, and as you know, Cumberland County has gone to the green stage, that has allowed some more things to open up. And then there are the camps, and there are so many other things that the Y is involved with. Going to green, what's changed for you, not you personally, but the Y, with these different stages of the COVID-19 mitigation efforts?
Sure. So as I said before, you know, originally as soon as we kind of went to the lockdown, we were closed entirely, which felt weird because we're part of the community and we're so used to being involved in so many facets, as you said, whether that's child care, whether that's swim lessons, that's camp, that's after-school care, before-school care. When that happened, that was just such a huge change for us. But we have been, as things unfold, as in the emergency child care waiver we received, and we started that as soon as we could. Now that camps are open, we started that as soon as we could. And then now going to green, we've reopened lap swimming for our pool and private lessons because, as you know, summer is a huge concern for a lot of parents being around water and making sure that their children are safe. So we really want to try and meet as many of those needs as our community as we can, as we're allowed to, and we're working, you know, as diligently as we can to make those things happen within the guidelines and the regulations that are being set forth by the state, but also by the CDC.
Understand that you have an overnight camp in Michaux State Forest. Is that allowed, that there will actually be kids allowed to spend overnights at camp?
Yeah, that was a big concern for us. We went ahead and registered for that camp, anticipating, as I think one of your guests said, we were you know, cautiously optimistic that that may or may not happen, because we do need to be in green for that to happen. So once we went to green, that was fine. But in anticipation of that, we actually moved back the start date of that camp by a week into July 5th. So normally we would have started that at the end of June, just to give us a little more time to prepare, make sure we're following all the guidance that is out there for us regarding overnight camps. And there is a specific section for overnight camps in the CDC guidelines regarding all summer camps.
How are you screening campers, the kids that are coming to you, staff, everyone, making sure that everyone's healthy?
Sure. Staff are a little different than our participants. Staff have kind of some non-negotiable things that they have to do, including wearing a mask. However, as far as campers or participants go, we've done a number of different things, including staggering drop-off pickup times. We've done curbside pickup and drop-off, so that means other folks other than the child are not really coming into our facility. It's just the camper comes to the facility. The staff members meet them at the curb, you know, do the health check on the camper before they enter camp. They do a sanitization of their hands before they even come into camp. They put their stuff in a specific area that gets fogged once they are in there, and then they start their day. At the end of the day, it's basically exact same thing on the way out. So basically we're sanitizing and checking on the way in, and we're sanitizing and checking on the way out of basically every group or every program that we're running.
That's what a lot of schools are doing with their sports programs, too. I want to thank the three guests for being with us today, Melissa Nash, Mertz, Jeremy Flores, Justin Rose. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.